Lecture 33, The 1840s, Growth of the Realistic Novel.
A theme running through these lectures, justifying the course's chronological organization, has been that various forms of literature bloom and flower at particular periods. And we can tie that phenomenon into the historical setting which gave the literature birth. Although we gather them and put them into a museum of the mind we call English literature, those great products of the human mind originate in specific times, places, and socio-historical circumstance. That's the soil in which they grew. We can pluck them, organize them into syllabi and curricula and canons and courses. But we should also look carefully at where they first sprouted. Now, to continue briefly with this horticultural theme, the 1840s saw a spectacular hothouse growth of one particular branch of English literature, the realistic, or as the Victorians called it, matter-of-fact, novel. That mirror in the roadway of everyday life, as Flaubert, writing fiction on the other side of the English Channel, called it. Now, the 1840s is a dynamic decade, not just in Britain, but in Europe, where it's associated with a second wave of revolution, the first being that triggered in the late 18th century in France and America. 1848 specifically was the year of revolution. Now, England escaped it, although it came close to social cataclysm in 1845 with the Great Chartist Uprising, which we'll be looking at more closely when we come to Disraeli's novel, Sybil. In England, particularly, the 1840s were years of great social distress. Trade depression had thrown millions into unemployment. The Hungry Forties, they were called. Fiction, particularly the novel with a purpose, that genre invented by Dickens with Oliver Twist, took full note of the hard times the working and lower classes were experiencing, as we'll see when, in a minute or two, we turn to Mary Barton. That's the title of the novel. But the novel did much more than isolate social problems in the 1840s. The great thinker or sage of the Victorian period, Thomas Carlyle, coined another term which more aptly covers what we can call the large enterprise of 1840s fiction. The condition of England question, Carlyle called it. Where was the country now? And what was the country going to? Novels of the 1840s give us a sense of English society in a crucial phase of its evolution, with unprecedented sensitivity and accuracy, even when, as many of them are, they're set in the past. They're symptomatic of the present. And novels were felt by readers of that time to be important. Fiction mattered in the 1840s in a way that it hadn't before, and very rarely has mattered since. Thackeray, of whom more later, declared that the novelist's role was as important as the parson's. And this, it should be said, at a period when Britain was much more religiously observant than it is today. It sounds pompous, but the Victorians, not least the Victorian novelists, believed it. Now, a minute or two ago, I mentioned Benjamin Disraeli, a future Prime Minister of England, and in the 1840s, a rising star in the Tory party, then a moribund, top-heavy political faction, which Disraeli would almost single-handedly revive. The future leader of England's revival program called it Young England. One nation conservatism was another Disraelian concept. Disraeli outlined this new vision of what a Tory-led England might be in what else novels of the 1840s, his so-called Young England trilogy. Now, it is, as I say, a mark of the prestige of the form at this period, that it could be used for such a purpose. You could use novels to define a political programme. I mean, can one, for example, imagine George Bush or Tony Blair expounding their political philosophy in a series of novels of ideas? It's true that Saddam Hussein wrote novels, but that's something else quite entirely. To say it again, the novel mattered in the 1840s. Never has Jane Austen's ironic self-belittlement, only a novel, been more forcefully refuted. Now, there are a number of socio-economic and cultural factors which also combine to produce this flowering of fiction and its dominance at this particular moment. What we see in mid-Victorian England is an enlargement of the reading public beyond that coterie, probably no more than a few thousand, which, for example, had supported Jane Austen in her novel writing 30 years earlier. Fiction has become a mass-market commodity by 1845. And we can even apply the term bestsellers to writers like Dickens, and I've been doing so. The novel, unlike, say, the street ballad, is an expensive commodity to produce and distribute. It presupposes a large literate public, which makes it a worthwhile financial proposition. Shakespeare could cater for audiences, many of whom could not read, or at least could not read as well as they could listen and watch, but novels require a higher level of education in the population, literacy. It is also the case that fiction is a complex literary form in which to respond intelligently to any one novel, one needs to have read many other novels, intertextuality, critics call it. And it's no coincidence that in the 1840s, the great circulating, that's lending libraries, begin to appear and dominate the distribution of fiction in the country's cities. It's no accident either that cheap reprints begin to appear, which make fiction accessible, relatively new fiction accessible, for relatively small amounts of money. Now, the Charles Dickens cheap edition in the early 1840s, for instance, made the great Inimitables, inimitably great works available to audiences of hundreds of thousands for pennies. So you've got this diffusion of fiction through large numbers of readers, and that is a new phenomenon. The main factor in the quite remarkable flowering of the novel in the 1840s, however, is at first sight rather more remote and perhaps rather unexpected, the railway. There was a vast and incredibly rapid growth in England of a national railway network from the mid-1830s to the late 1840s. Britain, as it had led the Industrial Revolution, led the way globally in the age of steam transport. And the country had certain advantages. Britain had certain advantages, not least, of course, that Britain invented the steam engine, or Stevenson did with his rocket train, and Watt with his discovery of steam-generated power before him. Britain, in other ways, is a conveniently compact landmass with a concentrated population, unlike, for instance, the continental spaces and dispersed population of the United States or the much larger and spread out territories of France and Germany. Huge wealth had been generated by the industrial powerhouse of the English North. Forget Rome, says a character in one of Disraeli's novels. Look at Manchester. That is the true wonder of history. The textile mills and factories of the time, he meant. And by the City of London and by the British Empire, securely held now that France had been finally defeated on the field of Waterloo, it was the English century. All that money in the city, all that power of the empire was floating around, looking for somewhere to invest itself, something to do. Some of it went into municipal constructions, into bridges, and obviously people like Isambard Kingdom Brunel created vast new things using the great toys at their disposal given them by the Industrial Revolution and the wealth which had been generated by it. But a bulk of this went into rail transport, the infrastructure which would make Great Britain, the United Kingdom, with those new cathedrals of the 1840s railway stations, genuinely the United Kingdom. Now, I want in this lecture to look at four great novels of the 1840s. Dombey and Son by Dickens, Mary Barton by Mrs. Gaskell, Sybil by Disraeli, and Vanity Fair by Thackeray. In two following lectures, I'll be looking in closer detail at two other great novels of the 1840s, Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, a feast of great fiction, a banquet. But let's begin with Dombey and Son, or, to give Dickens's novel its full title, Dealings with the Firm of Dombey and Son, Wholesale, Retail and for Exportation. Dombey and Son was first serialised in monthly parts from 1846 to 1848. There were 20 instalments, each with its curtain line or cliffhanger at the end to keep the reader coming back. The instalments came out under a uniform cover, and on this cover we'll notice that Dickens, unlike the author of Oliver Twist, which was looked at earlier, is now confident enough and authoritative enough to use his own name. He's Boz no longer. He was now 10 years into his career and the most famous novelist in England, well on the way, I think, to being the most famous novelist in history. The cover, which was designed by Fizz, whom he collaborated with all those years ago in Pickwick Papers, clearly reveals one of the main themes in the novel, capitalism. And so, of course, does the title point us in that direction. The cover has an image of the wheel of commercial fortune with its ups and downs. Now, Dombey and Son, like all the best titles in literature, is double-edged. Superficially, it's how dynastic firms advertise themselves to the consumer. You know, Dombey and Son, one can see it as a kind of nameplate over a shop or an establishment or a factory. Those monthly parts of Dombey and Son, which I've been talking about, were sold at railway bookstalls by W.H. Smith and Son, still the principal wholesaler of newspapers in Britain. But also, and this is the subversive theme in the novel Dombey and Son, the "and son" suffix indicates family relationships. Everywhere in the novels of the 1840s, one tracks the thinking of the philosopher I mentioned earlier, Thomas Carlyle. And among Carlyle's many potent arguments about signs of the times, about which he was rather gloomy, Carlyle argued that England must get away from cash nexus, the strictly financial relationships that capitalism sets up between people. Cash nexus must be replaced by something more organic, more familial. Society, as Carlyle saw it, was not a mere aggregate of buyers and sellers. It was more a gigantic family or clan with responsibilities and emotional ties to each other. Now, the story of Dombey and Son, which could as well have been called Dombey and Daughter, pivots on this Carlylean theme. Mr. Dombey, as we first meet him, is the proprietor of a large and hugely thriving firm which imports, exports and merchandises. What exactly the firm of Dombey deals in, we never quite know. It could be something very unpleasant. If this were the period when the British, for instance, were forcing the Chinese to import opium and deliberately addicting the Chinese population to that end in return for Chinese tea and silk, he could have been mixed up in all that. Two punitive wars were fought in the 1840s to ensure the Chinese did as their imperial masters, the British, told them. And what their imperial masters told them was to smoke opium. That's by the way. But as I say, Dickens doesn't tell us what the firm of Dombey and Son is dealing in. What Dickens does make clear is that Mr. Dombey is pride incarnate, and inevitably pride is riding for a fall. The narrative opens with the birth of a son, at last. It little matters to Mr. Dombey that his wife dies giving birth, or that he has a daughter, Florence, in the background. He has at last a son to carry forward the Dombey dynasty, the firm. Alas, the son, Paul, dies. Very prettily, it's one of Dickens's most heart-wrenching death scenes. Mr. Dombey, desperate for another young wife, he's not himself in the first flush of youth, nor physically attractive, goes hunting for a mate in the marriage markets, in the spa resorts of England. And he marries a cold-hearted woman, Edith, who accepts his offer out of cynical motives, cash nexus motives. She subsequently elopes with Dombey's villainous chief clerk, Carker, who's embezzled the firm, by the way. Mr. Dombey is financially ruined and emotionally shattered. Finally, he realises the true worth of his daughter. He realises that family matters more than commerce. His pride is crushed, his heart is softened. He is, like Scrooge on Christmas morning, after the spirits have done with him, a changed man. Now, the passage I want to quote from Dombey and Son illuminates another aspect of the novel. It is, I think, one of the most vivid scenes in all Victorian literature, and it relates to the railway boom I talked about earlier. After the death of his son, the firm's son, Paul, Mr. Dombey goes by train to Leamington Spa in search of a new Mrs. Dombey. It goes to the marriage markets, as I said. The railway, what we now know as the Great Western Railway, is spit new. The rails gleam like silver. New, too, is the magnificent railway station from which Mr. Dombey leaves London, Euston Station, with its magnificently newly constructed Doric arch. Now, Dickens captures perfectly that Victorian sense, as new to them as jet flight was to travellers in the 1950s, of being whirled along at the unimaginable pace of 50 miles an hour. But where was this speed, this awesome machinery taking them? Where was it taking England? The great Carlylean question. This is the description of Mr. Dombey on the train. Remember, he's just lost his son, Paul. Dombey found no pleasure or relief in the journey. Away with a shriek and a roar and a rattle from the town, burrowing among the dwellings of men and making the streets hum, flashing out into the meadows for a moment, mining in through the damp earth, booming on in darkness and heavy air, bursting out again into the sunny day so bright and wide. Away with a shriek and a roar and a rattle, through the fields, through the woods, through the corn, through the hay, through the chalk, through the mould, through the clay, through the rock, among objects close at hand and almost in the grasp, ever flying from the traveller, and a deceitful distance ever moving slowly within him, like as in the track of the remorseless monster, death. It's a wonderful passage. And mimetically, of course, Dickens gets the rhythm of the train. At that point, the rails weren't welded together. So, in fact, there was this kind of rhythm which Dickens, as I say, captures in his prose. But then there is that question at the end, where is it all taking us? Well, it is taking us, he indicates, to death. It's very powerful. And Dickens, in this passage, in this quotation, is, as it were, sort of answering, or at least trying to answer, trying to come to terms with the great Carlylean question. Now, Dombey and Son is a novel which moves on very interestingly from this point. That's to say, this train journey is right at the middle of the novel, and Dickens moves on from there to complicate things. He laid down very precise plans for this novel. By this stage of his career, he's a great planner of his fiction. What Dombey has to find at this point is the true and worthy ends of his existence. He has to find out why he matters and what he must do. And, as I say, what he discovers, and that's a great message, and Dickens makes it very convincing, is that family matters. It's his relationship with his daughter which eventually saves him. Let's move now to a less sophisticated but equally powerful novel of the same period, Mary Barton, which is subtitled A Manchester Story. Manchester, you remember, is, as the Israeli said, the new Rome, the new wonder of the world. It's by Mrs. Gaskell. We always call her Mrs., by the way. Mrs. Gaskell, born Elizabeth Stevenson, was born and brought up in London in comfortable circumstances, spent a lot of time in rural England. She married a Unitarian minister and moved with him, with William Gaskell, to Manchester in the industrial north. It was a jolting experience for this young woman. Manchester was the cauldron of the Industrial Revolution, the workshop of the world. It was also in the 1840s in the throes of industrial recession. The hungry 40s were hungriest there. Workers were starving. There were strikes, moves towards trade unionism, and a huge protest movement called Chartism, based on a charter with five basic principles: fair wages, security of work, and so on. There was a march on London, riot, and near revolution. The Chartist movement failed, but it was the basis for the growth of trade unionism and, 50 years later, the Labour Party in Britain. Mary Barton deals with all this, but interestingly, from the working class point of view. Mrs. Gaskell declared her intention was to give the dumb working classes a voice, and that voice would be her novel. She would articulate in fiction their plight and advocate connection, togetherness across the class divide between rich and poor, employer and employed. The novel's epigraph, unsurprisingly, is from Carlyle on just that theme. Mrs. Gaskell took to writing as therapy after the death of her only son, William, from scarlet fever. And this understandably cast a pall of melancholy over the narrative. Her original intention was to call the novel John Barton, but her publishers, conscious of the library market, persuaded her to skew the narrative towards John's daughter, Mary, and the complications of her love life. Now, the story is contemporary in its setting, simple in its outline, and powerful. John Barton is a mill worker in a textile factory. He's a happy man. But when trade depression hits, he is thrown out of work and his wife dies. He joins a trade union. Mrs. Gaskell feared and hated trade unions. He goes on the great Chartist demonstration to London, and when it fails, he comes back to Manchester embittered, he takes to opium, and finally he murders the son of a factory owner, an act of class revenge. He's not a bad man, Gaskell emphasises, but a good man made bad by hardship. The novel is melodramatic and, in its conclusion, highly romantic, but as I said, it has power. And that power lies principally in the first-hand depictions of what it is to be poor, so poor that one starves to death in utter destitution. The following is a description of the dwelling place of a fellow worker whom John Barton and a friend go to help. And this experience is something that predisposes Barton to his terrible act of assassination. They went along until they arrived in Berry Street. It was unpaved, and down the middle a gutter forced its way, every now and then forming pools in the holes with which the street abounded. Never was the old Edinburgh cry of "Garde de l'eau" more necessary than in the street. As they passed, women from their doors tossed household slops of every description into the gutter. They ran into the next pool, which overflowed and stagnated. Heaps of ashes were the stepping stones on which the passer-by, who cared in the least for cleanliness, took care not to put his foot. In other words, they have to walk through filth, human filth, excrement, to get to the hovel in which it turns out people are starving. Very, very powerful, very bitter, very angry novel. Sympathy and horror mix in depictions like this, and something, Mrs. Gaskell, novel urges, must be done. Of all the so-called social problem novels, Mary Barton, amateurish and mawkish as parts of it seem, is the most affecting, partly, I think, because it comes from a woman. I want to move now to the third of the novels, Sybil, or The Two Nations. It's another social problem novel, another vivid snapshot of mid-Victorian England. But Disraeli was more knowledgeable than Mrs. Gaskell could ever be. Sybil is the middle segment in that political Young England trilogy I was talking of earlier, in which Disraeli outlined his political philosophy. And Disraeli was less interested in changing hearts than in changing a political party, and through that the power structure of England. His novel depicts many of the same things as Mary Barton, the distress of the working classes in the industrial north, the Great Chartist Rebellion, but Disraeli's more analytic. And his analysis of the need for a radical change in British class structure is still potent in the political party he led for 30 years. People still talk about Disraelian one-nation Toryism. The plot of Sybil is simple. A young Lord Egremont decides to see what England is really like. He changes his name to that of a commoner and goes into the real world, the world of factories and commerce, of the workers at the face of the Industrial Revolution. There's a symbolic scene in a ruined abbey. Carlyle, incidentally, was also very keen on abbeys, seeing them as the ideal form of community in medieval England, something that should be recovered in modern England. But in Sybil, in the abbey grounds, Egremont, Franklin, as he now calls himself, has a highly instructive conversation with a trade union leader, Walter Gerard. The new reign, Egremont mentions, incidentally in the passage that follows, is Queen Victoria, who came to the throne 10 years earlier in 1837. "Well, we live in strange times," this is the conversation in the abbey, said Egremont, struck by the observation of his companion and relieving a perplexed spirit by an ordinary exclamation which often denotes that the mind is more stirring than it cares to acknowledge or at the moment is capable to express. Rather stilted English that Disraeli has, which I think explains why he hasn't lasted as well as some other novelists of the period. "When the infant begins to walk, it also thinks that it lives in strange times," said his companion. "Your inference?" asked Egremont. "That society, still in its infancy, is beginning to feel its way." "This is a new reign," said Egremont. "Perhaps it is a new era." "I think so," said the younger stranger. "I hope so," said the elder one. "Well, society may be in its infancy," said Egremont, slightly smiling, "but say what you like, our queen reigns over the greatest nation that ever existed." "Which nation?" asked the younger stranger, "for she reigns over two." The stranger paused. Egremont was silent, but looked inquiringly. "Yes," resumed the younger stranger after a moment's interval, "two nations, between whom there is no intercourse and no sympathy, who are as ignorant of each other's habits, thoughts, and feelings as if they were dwellers in different zones or inhabitants of different planets, who are formed by a different breeding, are fed by a different food, are ordered by different manners, and are not governed by the same laws." You speak of," said Egremont hesitatingly, "the rich and the poor." Egremont, after many travails, finally makes a marriage which unifies the classes, the rich and the poor. Society at large will probably have a harder time of it. But Disraeli's diagnosis, the connection must be found between those who have and those who have not, and that it is the duty of even conservatives, the landed party, the rich party, or the stupid party, as people sometimes call it. It is the Conservative duty as well to aspire to this, has energised British politics ever since Disraeli enunciated the message in the 1840s. And significantly, as I say, he chose to enunciate it in a novel. You could only, I believe, do that in the 1840s. Now, Disraeli and Mrs. Gaskell have a somewhat narrow mission. They focus on specific aspects of England and English life. And I want to finish by looking at a novelist whose range and vision is panoramic. Thackeray wrote his first novel after having been a writer for 15 years, a professional writer, in middle age. He called that novel Vanity Fair. Now, the name, you'll recall, was invented by Bunyan in The Pilgrim's Progress. Bunyan's Vanity Fair is London. Thackeray's is all England. And all the century up to the point in which he's writing, the mid-1840s. Thackeray's narrative has a vast narrative and canvas, covering a period from just before Waterloo, through that battle itself, which opened the way to England's century, and 100 years with that English century of unprecedented imperial power. He comes right the way through to the Victorian era. The story follows two heroines, one Becky Sharp is clever, astute, and when pushed to it, criminal. The other heroine, Amelia Sedley, is not clever, but she's a good woman. Their careers are intertwined, and they seesaw up and down. As the amoral Becky goes up, moral Amelia goes down, and vice versa. As we follow them from school days to middle age, Thackeray gives us a satirical, cynical, his contemporaries sometimes thought, portrait of an England permeated with a word which Thackeray invented, snobbery. Ours, he observes, is a ready money society, but it is also one which is distorted by the class system, by deference, truckling, as Thackeray saw it. Thackeray's Vanity Fair is a radical novel, but ultimately one which is rather world-weary, rather than one which actually demands world change. And above all, it's the tone of Thackeray's fiction which is most beguiling. His view of life is large and tolerant and tinged, as his contemporaries relished, with a sardonic wit. But one feels he sees all life in its complexity. He, of all the writers we've been talking about, and I include Dickens in this, had a sense of the largeness of the novel, if in fact you used it to its full extent. And the ending of Vanity Fair is, I think, one of the most breathtakingly unexpected endings in all 19th century fiction. Becky and Amelia, the bad woman and the good woman, who began life together as schoolgirls in the same school, end as respectable women. But where else in Vanity Fair? Even Becky, who's, we suspect, a murderess, ends up she doesn't, as it were, get the poetic justice which traditionally bad women, bad men get in fiction. That is part of Thackeray's tolerance. Some others would say of his cynicism. But this is how Thackeray closes proceedings in the novel. It's the most beautiful ending, I think. Ah, vanitas vanitatum. Which of us is happy in this world? Which of us has his desire? Or having it is satisfied? Come, children, let us shut up the box and the puppets, for our play is played out. The novel, one apprehends, is not merely entertaining. As Thackeray pointed out earlier, any clown can do that, can entertain us. It is instructing us how to live our lives, how, in fact, to actually make ourselves so that we can live our lives well. Now, the authority, the right to make such pronouncements, how to live your life, and have them taken seriously, is something which even the greatest novelists rarely achieve. And there are moments when, in fact, they're not allowed to achieve it because the spirit of the age is against it. In this lecture, what I've tried to show is that the 1840s, not just one novelist, but and that would be Dickens, I suppose, if one was thinking of the novelist of the age, but a whole generation of fiction writers achieved just that. They did achieve what Thackeray said the novelist at his greatest could achieve, the authority of the parson, the person who tells us how to live, and not only just tells us how to live, gives us useful advice on how to do it. This, as I've stressed throughout, is a decade when fiction mattered, and we can still enjoy it, even though we're not readers of the 1840s, and we can still respect it. even if it isn't speaking directly to us, we can respect the fact that it is saying something supremely important and using literature at its highest capacity to say those things and to do those things.